So we've seen that the case of the Great Western Schism completely refutes the advocates of the no jurisdiction position. So what do they do when presented with these facts? Well, most of them completely ignore it, but when they do address it, they sort of dishonestly shuffle it aside without actually addressing the issue at all. Here's an example of Jerry doing that very thing while making some other false arguments.
I mentioned some bad arguments near the end of my article. I give several of them, and several of them have already been shared today, so you can hear the arguments that Ken has made and hear what my responses to them would be. Pope Martin V's decree ad evitanda scandala, at the end of the Great Western Schism, is nothing to do with, doesn't help the CMRI out at all today, because a true pope at that point was supplying jurisdiction to those that were in good faith following a man that they believed was a true pope, like St. Vincent Ferrer. You can read all about that here.
This is a prime example of a bad argument, and how one shuffles aside without really addressing a fact which he cannot refute. The true popes were not explicitly authorizing or giving jurisdiction to the priests operating under the antipopes who opposed them. They did not do that. It was the church automatically giving it to them, just like the church automatically gives it to the independent priests who are operating or who might operate in good faith today, for the benefit of the faithful who might approach them in good faith today. To make the absurd statement that, well, that's different because there was a true pope reigning, that is ridiculous. In fact, if anything, the argument that the church would supply jurisdiction today would be even stronger, because there is no true pope, whereas during the Great Western Schism, these priests were operating under an anti-pope and actually choosing not to follow the lawfully elected pope and bishops. And so this is a subtly dishonest argument which might deceive those who aren't thinking more deeply about this issue or aren't as familiar with the issue, but it doesn't prove anything. And to say that ad evitanda scandala of Pope Martin V had nothing to do with this is misleading, because when he was resolving this confusion, he didn't mention any of these problems about the lack of jurisdiction for all of these years among all the priests who were operating under the anti-popes. And so there was no explicit authorization given by the popes to those priests under the anti-popes, contrary to what Jerry Matytic suggests. That's completely wrong, and it doesn't in any way refute the insuperable problem, which you cannot get around, that your position would require you to hold that all the priests who operated under the anti-popes and all the people who approached them for confessions, countless confessions, were all invalid. And that's not what the church taught. Here are some other false arguments from Jerry.
The concept of moral theology of Epikaia does not help out here at all. It's a much abused. This is the standard treatment, like Miaskevich on supply jurisdiction, by Father Riley. And you can see, and again, I have it all written out here for you in bad argument number 7. Epikaia doesn't help in this debate. It only applies to situations to which the lawgiver has not addressed himself, popes have addressed themselves to what you can and can't do when the papal see is vacant. It only applies in particular specific situations and not in general terms, as people have been now invoking it for decades. It can only be invoked by Catholics of good standing in the church. It only applies in the internal forum and not in the external forum. It does not objectively authorize external acts like ordaining priests and consecrating bishops. It can never confer jurisdiction. It applies to moral theology, not to canon law. Read the authorities themselves and see that.
There are a number of points that he brought up that need to be addressed. First, he tries to draw a sharp line between the issue of jurisdiction and epikaia. He essentially asserts that it's false to use epikaia as part of this debate. Epikaia is the principle of equity, the interpretation of a law whereby it is held not to bind in a particular case because some special hardship would result. So it absolutely has to do with law and whether one is bound to observe certain laws. To say that it has nothing to do with this issue, or to imply that, is very misleading. In fact, Father Maskevich, in a book he references repeatedly, Supply Jurisdiction According to Canon 209, he has a little section called Canon 209 in Epikaia on page 161. Likewise, Amleto C. Cognani, a pre-Vatican II canonist, and professor at the Pontifical Institute of Canon Law in Rome, repeatedly mentions Epikaia in his book, Canon Law. Obviously, it has a lot to do with this issue. Furthermore, if epikaia is inadmissible and misused, as he says, on what basis and on what grounds does he justify preaching? Jerry Matetics has an apostolate where he preaches all over the country and all over the world, in fact, giving talks, giving his view on scripture, giving his view on the church's teaching in the day, advising people on where they should, where they shouldn't go. He absolutely preaches. Now, this is clearly forbidden by canon law, and so this is one of the examples of his profound hypocrisy. And a little later on, we will see how he invokes the very principle that he called inadmissible in this debate. But before we return to that point, let's refute a little bit more of what he just said. Supposing for the sake of argument that what he says is true, that epikaia only applies to the internal, not the external forum, that it's not admissible in this debate, that it does not justify external acts such as ordinations, it doesn't supply jurisdiction, then his argument essentially translates into this: the church does not supply jurisdiction in the external forum. And that, of course, is completely wrong. For those who don't know, the internal forum is quorum Deo, what is done in the presence of God. The external forum is quorum ecclesia, what is done in the presence of the church. So essentially his argument is that the church does not supply jurisdiction in the external forum. For if that's not his argument, what's the point in saying that epikaia does not apply to the external forum? And that is completely wrong. The very code of canon law in canon 209 states, quote, in common error, or in positive or probable doubt about either law or fact, the church supplies jurisdiction for both the external and internal forum, end quote. Now, there are some other things that he said that need to be refuted. He said that epikaia only applies to situations which the Pope has not addressed, and that this is a period where there is no Pope, and Popes have addressed what you do in those situations. Well, that's a misleading argument, because the Popes did not address a situation where all of the bishops and all of the ordinaries that we know of fell into apostasy, so that there's not one legitimate ordinary to have recourse to. So that's misleading. Second, he says that epikaia only applies to those who are in good standing with the church, and what he really means is that supplied jurisdiction can only be granted to those who are already in good standing with the church. And we've already refuted that by citing the case of the Great Western Schism, where priests who were not in strictly good standing with the church received supplied jurisdiction. I will also be citing Maskevich and his work, where he clearly gives examples and mentions that the church does supply jurisdiction to those who are not in good standing with the church, and that it also supplies jurisdiction in the external forum. In addition, the breathtaking hypocrisy of this man cannot be underestimated. He will justify preaching and publishing religious works, which is forbidden according to the strict letter of canon law, which he is trying to bind and apply. He will repeatedly justify the violation of that canon law. He will cast it aside and say that it doesn't apply to him, that he's justified, but that people aren't justified in administering sacraments or getting ordained for the propagation of the faith. That's not necessary. That's not called for, according to him. But that it's necessary for him to preach, for him to publish, for the propagation of the faith. The hypocrisy is stunning. He's condemned out of his own mouth. And at the same time, this heretic tramples upon the divine law because, as we cover in another audio, he justifies and acknowledges as Catholics people who deny the divine law, the dogma that you have to believe in Jesus Christ for salvation. So his devilish hypocrisy is really profound. Now, I want to address more of Jerry's arguments and refute them. In the following clip, I want people to pay attention to two points. First, notice how Jerry presents himself as a warm and loving friend. He speaks in soft and apparently charitable words. And this is very deceptive. And this is frequently how the devil kills souls. It's frankly equivalent to how a serpent will cuddle up next to someone and then try to bite him. He will lure them in with a warm personality, but if you analyze the content of what he's saying, it's actually deadly. Is he really their friends? What he's saying about these same people is that their priests are bastard priests, their confessions are invalid, that their churches are the equivalent of constructions of schismatics, equivalent to the schismatic national church or the Russian Orthodox Church. And so it's a frequent mechanism of the devil to present himself in a very friendly fashion, but then deliver a deadly message. And we've often been falsely accused of a lack of charity because we're blunt, we're upfront, we're honest. We will tell you how we feel. If you're not our friend, we're not going to act like you are our friend. And that's actually truly charitable, truly honest, and not phony. But this individual, throughout this talk, repeatedly praised their sincerity, how much he thinks of them, etc., except for the fact that he thinks that they're essentially schismatics, that they're renegades. He even compares their activity of ordaining people without proper authorization to the sin of incest committed by Lot's daughters. So just pay attention to that deceptive way of presenting the deadly message. And then also focus on his reference to Mascavige, because I will respond by analyzing what Mascavige actually says and how it obliterates their whole position.
Now, I want to reiterate, I want to encourage you please to read the handout carefully when you have a chance, and I want to reiterate what I said at the beginning of it, that I don't say any of the things that I'm saying now or said this afternoon with any ill will towards anybody here. I love everybody here. I want you to be pleasing to God. I want to be pleasing to God. I want to pray for you. I want you to pray for me. I want to consider you a friend and someone that we can work together and pray together and do God's will and God's work together. But I do believe with all of my heart that these issues have not been properly substantiated. The issue of mission has not been addressed. I would encourage you to read St. Francis de Sales. With all respect to Ken, although law does supply jurisdiction in very specifically circumscribed situations that the canon law itself tells us about. See, the whole purpose of canon law is to give you laws that bind, and then to say, but they don't bind in this situation or that situation. You can't say because some exceptions are made, therefore, you know, it's a free-for-all. And we can start doing things that the canon law does not give us the authority to do, such as to say, look, we haven't had a priest, a pope for a long time, so let's start making bishops without papal mandate. Canon law talks about what you do when there's no pope. Popes have passed legislation saying, here's what needs to happen for the next pope to be elected. And they have never, I challenged Ken and he said, there isn't any. No pope in the 2,000-year history of the church has said, look, if a certain amount of time goes ticking off on your timer and no pope is around, then you better go ahead and start doing this. And in the absence of that license, that liberty, that authorization, we are sinning mortally in doing this. I say this with love. There is such a thing as supply jurisdiction, but it does not apply to this situation. Supply jurisdiction, there's a whole book on it. Classic treatment on it by Father Vyaskievich, supply jurisdiction according to Canon 209. Everyone cites it. You can read this whole book and be happy to make you a copy if you can't find it. I think it's available on the internet, I was told. But you can read it for yourself and you will see that everyone that reads this whole book and studies it says this book devastates the traditionalist movement today that says we can make our own priests and we can make our own bishops.
Before I get into Mascavige's book, allow me to note that he repeats some of the same false arguments on mission, which was refuted by giving examples during the Great Western Schism, where priests who were not properly authorized or given missions were subsequently looked upon as having acted legitimately due to the confusion or the doubt of fact that would apply to a doubt of law or a common error scenario, as we will show. He mentions that popes did not authorize consecrating bishops when you did not have a pope, but as we said, this is not to the point, because they did not address a situation where all of the bishops, all of the ordinaries that we know of, fell into apostasy. Furthermore, it's simply a fact of early church history that many consecrations of bishops were done without papal knowledge or prior approval, and that those consecrations were subsequently looked upon as legitimate. Anyone who studies the early church carefully knows that the popes were not involved in many of the consecrations simply due to either the distance, the lack of communication, or the political situations that arose. There were all kinds of bishops who were being implanted and then removed. And in many cases, some who started out as not being properly consecrated with the legitimate approval of the Pope were looked upon as legitimate later on. There are many examples of that. He says that the Church only supplies jurisdiction in specifically circumscribed areas. Completely wrong. If that were true, as we said, if he were true to his argument, which he's not, if he were honest, which he's not, he would say that all the priests in the Great Western Schism who were not properly approved could not have had supplied jurisdiction, because it only applies in specifically circumscribed areas, not for repeated acts. And then there are many other examples in church history where you had priests who were maybe ordained by a bishop whose election was laboring under some defect, but they were, of course, considered to have jurisdiction. He says that anyone who studies Father Maskevich's book on supplied jurisdiction according to Canon 209 agrees that it devastates the traditionalist position that the Church will supply jurisdiction for these different acts, for ordaining priests, for hearing confessions, etc. That is completely wrong. I've read and studied the book, and I believe it devastates your position. And this is particularly significant because the principles he applies and the teachings he enunciates were written during his time, before Vatican II, around 1940, when there were bishops all over the place, priests all over the place. So even within a properly functioning hierarchical framework, he's still finding all kinds of examples where jurisdiction would have to be supplied by the Church, where the Church would supply it. What would he say if he were writing that for our situation, where there are no proper bishops at all? And so what he says even applies, even has a greater magnitude in terms of the force of the argument, if we consider what he was not thinking about when making these statements. And I'm going to cover what he was saying. Now, in Maskevich's work, he admits that in the early church, they didn't even make the distinction of supplied jurisdiction. This wasn't even articulated in detail until the second millennium. Think about that. With all of the countless examples of bishops being invalidly installed, priests being ordained under bishops who were not properly installed, there are countless examples of this, and they didn't even articulate a distinction of jurisdiction because they understood that the Church will supply it in any reasonable circumstance. Here's what Maskevich says on page 42. Quote, "Abuses of usurpation of ecclesiastical authority existed in the Church from the earliest centuries. The councils strove to eradicate these evils, but as regards the acts performed by these usurpers, for people who were unaware of their incompetency, there was never raised any question about their jurisdictional validity." Wilches carefully adds that before Gratian there was no word of formal supplying of jurisdiction by the Church. In fact, he points out there could not be any, inasmuch as the doctrine about jurisdiction was not yet fully developed. End quote. And so they didn't even get into these precise debates because they understood that if a person acted in good faith, or if there was a reason, or if there was a reasonability to presume that a person should have acted in this fashion, the Church would supply the jurisdiction. Now we need to cover how Maskevich admits that the Church will supply jurisdiction even to someone who does not have a title, to someone who has a colored title or a putative title. I will quickly explain what those mean and why that's significant. When a bishop, for instance, is legitimately installed as the Bishop of Philadelphia, he would have a title. That would be true title. A colored title would be one which has the appearance of a true title, insofar as it is conferred by a competent superior. However, it labors under a hidden defect which vitiates it. So, for instance, a true superior would nominate someone for a particular office or appoint him to that office, but there was a hidden defect in how he was approved. That would be a colored title. A putative title would be one where a person pretends to be endowed with power, but he in fact has no rightful claim to that position and was not conferred by a legitimate superior. So, for instance, when an emperor would install a bishop and say he is the Bishop of Alexandria and boot out the true bishop, that would be a putative title. And to better understand this, let's look at a real historical example of putative title. During the reign of Pope St. Leo the Great in the 5th century, in approximately 448 to 450, and actually in 449, a council was held at Ephesus called Ephesus II. It is a notorious robber council. This council was held by Monophysite heretics, but papal legates of Pope Leo the Great were there, and also the true bishop of Constantinople, Patriarch Flavian. The Monophysites essentially hijacked the council, and it was an invalid and robber council, and they actually beat up Patriarch Flavian. The papal legates left, and Leo the Great rejected this heretical council. However, since the emperor was behind the Monophysites, he kicked out Patriarch Flavian, the true Catholic bishop and the rightful possessor of the See of Constantinople, and sent him into exile. And he put in his place Patriarch Anatolius. Pope St. Leo the Great obviously refused to recognize Anatolius's claim on the See of Constantinople. So Anatolius was not the true bishop of Constantinople. Flavian was, at least before he died. Now Anatolius eventually changed his position and anathematized certain heretics and certain heresies, which enabled Pope Leo the Great to recognize him at that point as the true bishop of Constantinople. So Anatolius started out as one having only putative title to the See of Constantinople. He was not conferred by a legitimate superior, but claimed to have that title unlawfully, unjustly. It wouldn't be colored title because it wasn't conferred by the legitimate superior, such as Pope St. Leo the Great. But obviously not all of the inhabitants of Constantinople were privy to all of these goings-on. So were all the confessions invalid, or at least those which were heard by the priests raised by Anatolius? It's not known, it wasn't even addressed. That's an example of where the church would supply jurisdiction for certain acts, even of one who has only putative title, essentially usurper, or one who has no rightful claim to the position. And Mascaviach admits in his work that the church will supply jurisdiction, obviously, when one only has colored title and putative title and even no title. For example, on page 26 of his work, he says, quote, "Thus supplied jurisdiction may make valid the absolutions of a putative confessor," end quote, meaning one who is not the legitimate confessor at all. And he even spends some time commenting on the precise wording of Canon 209, which says that the church will supply jurisdiction in either common error or in probable doubt of law or in probable doubt of fact, and that the church will supply jurisdiction in any of those cases to both the external and internal forum. And he makes a note in his discussions of how if a specific title or any kind of title were required, that would have been mentioned in Canon 209, and that the fact that it was not mentioned means that it's not, strictly speaking, required for the church to supply jurisdiction. So he concludes that if one of those three things is present, and common error is often intertwined with probable doubt of fact or law, then the church will supply jurisdiction. And the reason for this is that all of these laws are intended for the salvation of souls. And when they come to impede that, because, for instance, a circumstance arises which was not envisioned by the lawgiver, they do not bind. That's what these pharisaical no-jurisdiction advocates do not understand. They are not dogmas. They are not divine laws. These are canon laws. And in commenting on the history of canon law and how it came to develop from the Roman law, Mascaviach says on page 39, quote, "They were becoming more and more convinced that the legislator did not intend any man-made laws to bind any longer. If, when, and as the observance of that law or its enforcement would defeat the very purpose of the institution, namely the public good," end quote. Now, I want to return to that point, but first I want to cover a few other things. Mascaviach says clearly and admits that the church will supply jurisdiction to someone who has not had it before. This refutes many of the no jurisdiction position advocates, if not all of them, because many of them say that the church cannot give it to someone who has not had it before, or who is not, quote, "in good standing with the church." And Mascaviach says on page 25, quote, "Canon 209 is an instance in the code which reveals that the church does supply in conditions of common error or of a positive and probable doubt of fact or of law. In virtue of this supplying, the Church may grant jurisdiction to one who until now has not possessed any." End quote. Okay, so that refutes a popular error that these no jurisdiction schismatic spread, and we already refuted that by giving examples in the Great Western Schism. Returning to the point about the purpose of canon law and these laws, as distinct from the divinely revealed truths that cannot admit of any exceptions or revocation. Mascavige says on page 144, quote, "So too, in regard to her jurisdictional laws, the legislator has given innumerable signs of benignity and of grave concern for the good of the faithful. Above all, he has always been careful that his restrictions should never defeat, by their consistency and rigidity, their chief and ultimate purpose, the common good." End quote. And that brings us to another point which is crucial to understanding this issue properly. The advocates of the no jurisdiction position fail to make an important distinction. They will often cite church teachings and papal statements that the necessity to have jurisdiction is de fide. It's dogmatic. That's true. But they are failing to distinguish between the necessity to have jurisdiction, which is of divine law, and the way that jurisdiction is dispensed in the church, which is of ecclesiastical law. This distinction is of paramount importance in understanding this issue properly. The laws surrounding how a priest gets jurisdiction are ecclesiastical laws. The necessity for him to have it is divine law. And that's why we can see how the church can supply jurisdiction to someone who has never had it before. He needs to have it to forgive sins validly, but he doesn't need to get it from a bishop to have it in every case. That's the distinction they fail to mention. So all their papal statements about how the Pope has supreme jurisdiction in the church, etc., it's all beside the point. No one's denying that. It's simply a fact that the way that the jurisdiction is dispensed in the church is not strictly a matter of divine law or a dogmatic issue. Another interesting thing to mention is what Mascavige says concerning undeclared heretics and declared heretics. Some people say that the church could never supply jurisdiction to a heretic, declared or undeclared, and that the references to the excommunicated being able to perform certain acts with jurisdictional validity refers to people who are under excommunications that don't involve heresy, such as a minor excommunication, etc. Well, Mascavige contradicts that when he says on page 19, quote, "The censured heretics and schismatics are not fit subjects of jurisdiction, inasmuch as their transgression has placed them outside the pale of active membership in the church. Such persons are always forbidden to exercise jurisdictional power, under the sanction that such an exercise will be an unlawful act. However, not always are their acts invalid, as canons 2265.1, number 2, etc., explicitly state. It is only when such a person is a vitandus, or when a declaratory sentence has been executed against him, that his jurisdictional acts will be invalid." End quote. That shows that he also believes that the church will supply jurisdiction, for instance, for the validity of the confessions of an undeclared heretic, a priest who may profess to be Catholic, profess to be traditionalist, but in fact, sadly, is a heretic on one or more issues, but isn't as notorious as someone like Benedict XVI, or obviously a Protestant or an Eastern schismatic. Now, some also have confusion on this because they say, well, then couldn't a heretic maintain the jurisdiction of the papal office if heretics can have validity to some of their jurisdictional acts? And the answer is no, because the papal office comes with supreme jurisdiction. No one outside the church could have universal jurisdiction. The church would supply jurisdiction to an undeclared heretic in certain circumstances for specific acts, such as absolving a penitent. But he could not possess universal jurisdiction or any jurisdiction which involves ruling, such as the position of head of the universal church. Now, it's necessary to cover a few more points from Mascavige. He admits that Canon 209 definitely applies to the external and internal forum. He admits that it applies to marriages and assistance at marriages, which is, he points out, not strictly speaking a jurisdictional act, but connected with it. and thus he speaks at length on how it is intertwined with this issue of the church supplying jurisdiction to the external form. On page 221, he says that, quote, Canon 209 has a much broader field of operation and application. As a matter of fact, it applies to all kinds of jurisdictional activity. It applies equally to the power to absolve from censures, to grant indulgences, to dispense from matrimonial impediments, to direct a judicial process, etc., end quote. So he's talking in the context here of when there would be a common error or a doubt of fact about who the proper bishop would be, that in his view, the church could supply jurisdiction for those other acts, thus proving that it's not limited strictly to certain acts of the internal form. And on page 228, he gives an example. He says, quote, for example, a commonly but falsely reputed pastor validly absolves from sin, dispenses from the impediments of marriage, and dispenses from the law of assisting at Mass on Sundays and holy days, as well as from the law of fast and abstinence, end quote. Now he says for this to work, common error, or a positive and probable doubt about either law or fact, must exist. Now let's talk a little bit about doubt of law and doubt of fact. A doubt of fact is a situation where someone is reputed to be the pastor or the bishop who is in fact not. The case we discussed of Anatolius would be a doubt of fact among those who considered him to be the true bishop of Constantinople when in fact he was not. And that if there is a positive or probable doubt of fact, the church will supply jurisdiction. The case of the Great Western Schism would also be an example of doubt of fact, where people thought that this was their bishop, that this was the superior of the religious order, because they considered the Avignon line of antipopes to be the true popes. The truth was to the contrary, and so there was a positive and probable doubt of fact. But the church will also supply jurisdiction in a positive or probable doubt of law, so that if a prudent man considers that this law does not bind or does not exist, the church will supply jurisdiction. And Miscavige makes the point that the church will supply jurisdiction equally in those cases, whether it's a situation of common error or a positive and probable doubt of law or of fact. And it's very interesting that Miscavige on page 101 makes reference to St. Alphonsus on this topic. And he points out that St. Alphonsus didn't really even distinguish between doubt of fact or doubt of law, that the church would simply supply the jurisdiction, essentially in any reasonable case. And I'm going to quote that. Miscavige, page 101, quote, it is a remarkable fact that St. Alphonsus Liguori, in treating of the subject of probable jurisdiction, did not make any note of the distinction of the dubium juris and dubium facti, meaning doubt of law and doubt of fact. This is particularly arresting when one remembers with what meticulous care St. Alphonsus habitually sought to portray controverted points in proper contrast and relief. Castrillon took it as an indication that St. Alphonsus himself held that the probability which arose from a factual doubt and the probability which sprang from a juridical doubt, meaning doubt of law, equally warranted the affecting of validity in jurisdictional acts, end quote. Miscavige also points out on page 97 that St. Alphonsus held the opinion that the sufficiency of common error alone without any title was, quote, deservedly probable. So he didn't even have to look like the Bishop of Constantinople to have jurisdiction supplied to him, according to St. Alphonsus. Now, in unison with this, we must talk about what Miscavige says. He says that the church will supply jurisdiction in any probable case, and this is very interesting. Unlike in the sacraments, where there must be a certainty of validity, or there cannot be any objective doubt about the validity of the matter or the form, if there is, you must avoid the sacrament. In terms of jurisdictional validity, the burden of proof is on those who attack the act's validity. On page 192, Miscavige says, quote, if there should be question of a jurisdictional act posited in the external forum, and the act's validity is questioned on the ground of defect of jurisdiction and of common error, the presumption stands for the validity of the act, and the burden of proof lies on the one attacking the act's validity, end quote. Now, in this context, it's very important to point out that Miscavige goes on and on about how the church in any questionable matters has to be considered, or most commentators consider the church would supply the jurisdiction, because if it wouldn't, then there would be massive confusion and uncertainty. And that's why he goes on and on explaining how this position developed of probable jurisdiction. And this point, in addition to all the others we've covered, frankly devastates the advocates of the no jurisdiction position. Mascavige says on page 89, quote, "In the meantime, between the 12th and 16th centuries, there had sprung up a universal custom on the part of confessors to absolve with only probable jurisdiction, that is, to act on the conviction that when they did so, the validity of the sacrament was still sufficiently safeguarded." End quote. So if it was reasonable that they could absolve, they would do it, and they were confident that the church would supply it, as long as it was probably reasonable. On page 92, Mascavige references Sanchez, a theologian, and he says, quote, "His point was that as long as the objective truth were not apparent, as long as the opinion asserting the presence or the sufficiency of jurisdiction were solid enough to win the assent of prudent men, the acts performed in virtue of it would be valid." End quote. So, as long as a prudent man considered that this is a justified act and that God would not necessarily want this act forbidden, the church would supply jurisdiction in such a probable case. And this coincides perfectly with what we instinctively thought all along, that the jurisdictional laws are there to provide a certain framework, a certain regulation, that people should operate within these bounds in normal times. But the church will supply it because they're only human laws. They are backed up by the divine authority of the church, but they're not divine laws like dogmas. And so the only times where a confession would be invalid by virtue of a lack of jurisdiction on the part of the priest would be situations where the penitent was deliberately acting against church law in a normal circumstance, deliberately refusing to go to the one to whom he should go and going to someone else, or knowingly going to a notoriously heretical member of a sect, such as a Greek Orthodox bishop, to have his sins absolved. Any other cases which might arise where there could be any reasonable level of confusion, the church will supply jurisdiction, and that's why all these authors say that in any probable case it will, and it certainly will in this situation where every ordinary that we know of has fallen into apostasy, there are no ordinaries, and the church needs to have confessions heard for people to be forgiven of sins, and it is not reasonable at all to think that God would not want people having their sins forgiven. And what I've been saying is backed up by what Mascavige covers regarding the validity of marriages. He points out how certain marriages were considered invalid in the cases where the married individuals would deliberately shun the proper pastor or knowingly neglect to be married in front of the person they should have been married in front of, showing no regard for church law at all. But if there was any level of confusion about who could assist at the marriage's validity was upheld. And so the cases we're talking about in this situation are not comparable at all to people who deliberately act against church law in a normal circumstance. This is not a normal circumstance at all. Here's another quote from Mascavige, page 95. Tamburini also pointed out, and many others, after the manner of Bonancina, that probability was of itself, apart from common error, a sure guarantee of jurisdiction. Among these scholars, perhaps the boldest champion was Vericelli. He was so convinced of the truth of his own opinion that he termed the opposite view utterly false and improbable. Tamburini, who followed Vericelli, was an almost equally ardent adherent of this opinion. Tamburini gave as his reason why he considered this opinion the more probable the fact that universal custom gave jurisdiction. Thus, this universal custom was the principal argument upon which these scholars rested their claim of certitude of jurisdiction in cases of probability. End quote. Here's another final interesting quote on this point on page 98 of Mascavige. Quote, "Certainly from the days of St. Alphonsus to the appearance of the code, the legal factor of probability was ever more and more received as a guarantee for supplatory jurisdiction. But as Bucceroni, Lemkul, Danibal have indicated, the most commonly used argument to support the claim that in probable jurisdiction there was inherent the guarantee of an assuredly real jurisdiction was the fact of its customarily and universally accredited usage." End quote. So if a prudent man considers the acts justified and not an infringement upon church law or the will of God or the Catholic faith, the church will supply jurisdiction in all those cases of probability. It's only when someone's deliberately acting outside the bounds of church law in an unjustified way that the acts will be invalid, or the people going to them. And even in that case, it would be supplied for someone going to them.